Good evening. I'm Dave Davies, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Long-suffering Eagles fans have been treated to an enchanted season, and tonight they can experience the magic of claiming the top seed in the playoffs at home on Christmas night. WHYY's Aaron Mozell rode his sleigh to South Philly to talk to some tailgaters before the big game. Here's his report.
The cold, blustery parking lots outside Lincoln Financial Field started filling up 7 hours before kickoff. By 2 p.m., Greg Buchanan and his crew were already in the middle of setting up their tailgating space near AT&T Station. They're cooking Christmas Day dinner down here.
Turkey, pork loin, tater tots with chili, ham, anything else we can find to deep fry. If you brought anything, we'll deep fry that.
Buchanan has been a season ticket holder for more than 2 decades. He's got a tattered Eagles jean jacket to prove it. In 23 years, Buchanan has never missed a home game, making this morning a little hectic.
I cooked breakfast for everyone. Everyone ate. All the little kids opened their gifts. There's a lot of wrapping paper. Santa did a good job.
Rose Cunningham has had season tickets for nearly 20 years. Her family exchanged gifts last night.
We had to get out and get ready for the tailgate, had to get the food ready, get the bus ready. We had a busy morning.
At 12-2, the Eagles are already division champs, but a win tonight would give them home field advantage throughout the playoffs. It should be manageable. The Raiders are just 6-8. That didn't stop Steve Cook from flying with his family from Riverside, California.
I became a Raider fan when I was 7 years old when we beat the Washington Redskins 38-9 in Super Bowl 1984.
Cook says it won't be easy to win tonight, but he's always wanted to go to a game in Philly. He's always heard Eagles fans are tough. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
There's a common story told about rural areas in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. As the steel and coal industries fade, small towns here are dying. Young people move away because they just can't find decent jobs. But for the past 20 years, some entrepreneurs have been quietly working on a different narrative, one that harnesses the state's natural beauty to build the economy. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
About 10 years ago, after a long career in computer sales, Rod Darby was downsized and out of work.
And I got angry about that, so I thought I'm never going to work for somebody else again, so I'm going to go start my own business.
As he researched what that business would be, he started noticing a lot of activity around the Great Allegheny Passage, a 150-mile bike trail along an old rail line connecting Pittsburgh to Cumberland, Maryland. Construction was still in progress then, but it's since been completed. Darby wrote up a business plan to open a bar and restaurant along the trail in West Newton. It's about 30 miles south of Pittsburgh. He shopped the idea around.
I went to a large bank. They said, nope, that's not what we do. Went to a medium-sized bank. Hey, great plan. That's not what we do. Went to a small bank. Great plan. We're not sure about this trail.
Then he went to a community development program called the Progress Fund.
And they said, this is exactly what we do. And they've been a fantastic partner for me since we started.
David Cayley, co-founder of the Progress Fund, saw a need to support tourism in the region 20 years ago.
So we started basically a nonprofit bank and started making loans to small businesses.
Funded by a variety of state and federal agencies, private foundations, and commercial banks, they initially invested in nearby Ohiopyle, financing a whitewater rafting facility, a bed and breakfast, and other tourism projects. Today, it's bustling with cyclists, hikers, and rafters spending money to eat, shop, and stay overnight. Cayley wanted to try something similar in West Newton, which is only a 34-mile bike ride from Pittsburgh. Then Rod Darby walked in the door.
Rod became one of the first people outside of Ohiopyle to start investing in the other little towns. So when he approached and said, I want to do something here, we were jumping for joy.
Today, Darby's Trailside Restaurant serves pub food, boasts a full bar, and a takeout beer shop.
Any particular flavor, Dave?
28 people work here, 16 full-time. And Darby says business is hopping.
People ask me all the time, does that trail help you out? And I said, the trail's the reason I'm here.
The Progress Fund's David Cayley walks just a few feet from the restaurant onto that bike trail that runs along the river.
We have all these nifty signs so you don't get lost.
The fund invested in pizza and fast food restaurants here, a kayak shop, and the renovation of a bed and breakfast.
Well, we have 9 loans that we've done in West Newton, and it's really that kind of level of investments changing West Newton's future around tourism. Why 9 loans here? Well, that Great Allegheny Passage is a huge economic opportunity.
Based on studies and surveys over 17 years, the Progress Fund estimates nearly 1 million people use the Gap Trail each year. And according to the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, it generates more than $40 million in revenue annually. As the steel and coal industries have declined, Kaylee says West Newton and other towns in the region have faced years of disinvestment. He says the Progress Fund is trying to help them see what they do have to offer.
The resource here is the landscape and all the recreational opportunities. So it is a fully invested economic development program, but it's one that relies on the environmental aspects or environmental qualities of the community rather than being the extractive industry.
Walking down the trail, the tracks are gone, but the old train station has been renovated into a new visitor center.
Hey, wake up.
Who's here?
Hi.
Hi.
The Bright Morning Bed and Breakfast is just a few steps away. Mary Lou Randulik and her husband have renovated a series of late Victorian-era homes conveniently located for cyclists.
Common area, living room, kitchen.
She walks me to an outdoor patio that looks almost like it could become a restaurant. They even have a liquor license.
So we're walking from one B&B to the next.
It's like a campus.
When they first moved in, Randulik says the nearby train station was still dilapidated. This was literally considered the wrong side of the rail tracks when she was growing up across the river in West Newton.
When I bought the first one and I moved in, I remember thinking, what did I do? I bought a house in the place in town where nobody would ever go.
But she soon started hearing from friends who enjoyed the trail access and wanted a place to stay. Randulik and her husband started renovating with the bed and breakfast in mind. The Progress Fund helped as they continued to expand. Now all 4 Bright Morning houses stay busy with overnight guests.
I don't have a number, but we've had night after night after night, and it can be any day of the week.
Kent Spellman is encouraged by the results of the Progress Fund. He's pushing for this kind of development along West Virginia's abandoned train tracks, too.
I'm a consultant with the Rails to Trails Conservancy out of Washington, D.C.
Spellman has spent most of his life in West Virginia. He says some communities are suffering from something like post-traumatic stress disorder because of the loss of industry in recent decades.
Their future, too often, in southern West Virginia, but also in many northern West Virginia communities, has been determined by that big extractive industry, or that big steel mill, or that big chemical company. Those things are going away, and it's, I think, a time for us in rural Appalachia to start understanding that we have to take responsibility for our future ourselves.
Spellman is currently focused on completing a 230-mile rail trail from Parkersburg to Morgantown, hooking up with the Great Allegheny Passage into Pittsburgh. He sees rail trails as the new Main Street, the place where people walk their dogs and talk with neighbors. He says the cycling tourism is important and can showcase the beauty and livability of West Virginia, but it's really just a means to build a broader economy.
And if we get just a small percentage of the people who come through our communities to be thinking down the road about maybe that would be a good place to rear a family, maybe that would be a good place to bring my small business, that is the goal of tourism.
Mary Popovich agrees. She's the mayor of West Newton and today sits at a beautifully renovated downtown building looking out onto the Youghiogheny. She says thanks to the trail and the economic development around it, there's excitement in her old coal town. Even the elementary school that almost closed is now seeing increased enrollment.
There's a lot of houses that are getting sold to young families. This is how you help your community grow in numbers, and then you're going to get more businesses.
The Progress Fund has invested a lot in West Newton, hoping other former coal towns will look here and start reimagining their futures as trail towns. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front reports on environmental issues in Pennsylvania. This story was produced in collaboration with West Virginia Public Broadcasting through a grant from the Benedum Foundation. Many of us think as Christmas has becoming over-commercialized in recent decades, with marketers and retailers hyping the season to get Americans to spend more. But the practice of over-consuming during the holidays actually goes back much further. Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller explored just how far back with Rutgers University Associate Professor Aaron Hostetter.
So how far back does this go? What's the origin?
Well,
It predates the credit card.
Yes, predates the credit card, but quite a bit. Holidays in general map onto a cycle of feast and famine and how that becomes expressed as European society goes on in the carnivalesque, which is the kind of licensed overindulgence. There's an important festival in the Roman calendar, Saturnalia, which happens right around winter solstice. And that's involved with, making children and fools kings and things like that for the day, and then celebrating and running around the streets and eating lots of food. It's partly a defiance of the shortness of the year at the winter solstice. So you eat your stores of your grain and your food that you've harvested over the years, and you imbibe your drinks and you party to sort of show that life goes on.
Kind of in defiance.
In defiance. Absolutely in defiance of the shortness of the year. And that's why the Yule fires, why you have a Yule fire, a Yule log, is to burn a big fire, which is meant to make the sun come back.
Practiced principally by those of means, or even
strata? All strata, and that's part of the beauty of the holidays as practiced in these cultures, is that they were great levelers, because social binaries tended to be inverted, and so people would mix, or there would be more opportunity for cross class contact.
Overindulgence primarily in terms of food, or was there also some semblance of gift giving?
Gift giving is part of that as well. Gift giving is a way to, overindulge in a way, to give of yourself what you've earned over the year to your neighbors and to your friends and to your loved ones, to kind of cohere the society into bonds.
So we touched initially on Roman pagan times. Were practitioners during the era of Beowulf and Chaucer invoking those previous Roman times?
It over time, yes. The medieval calendar didn't really celebrate Christmas the way that modern Christianity does. Christmas was a minor holiday. There was a feast of the Nativity, and there were several important feast days, like December 6th was the feast of St. Nicholas. And partially because of biblical injunctions in the Gospels about what Jesus said about his birth and celebrating his death instead of his birth, but also because the new year wasn't for another 3 months. So there wasn't any big reason. There was just the winter solstice. There wasn't this sort of conglomeration of holidays within a 6 or 7 day period like there is now.
Lots of feasting, but eventually you have to pay the piper. Was there then the common period of famine?
Right, exactly. Well, that's the thing, is that it's a really good idea economically to stage a large feast in the spring, because you're waiting for the crops to grow. So you're running out of your winter stores. So you might as well encourage people to eat less so that everybody can get by.
So this is based both on the agricultural rhythm and the amount of daylight. And, of course, the weather and the amount of daylight also ties back into the agricultural cycle.
Absolutely. So it all goes together. And when Christianity was taking over in Europe, they saw that people were celebrating on these days anyway, in the spring, around Halloween, in the winter, around the solstices. They instituted feasts on those days because people were partying anyway. So that's a good way to say, well, you can follow the new religion and still keep your old calendars.
Of course, advanced to current times, and some would say it's capitalism run amok.
Yes, absolutely. And so it's capitalism's very good at grafting on to practices like this, profligacy, conspicuous consumption.
I'm curious, with your interest and focus on medieval times, how much of that is in your awareness as you get ready to embrace the holiday?
It's interesting, yeah. I love holiday season eating, right? That's my big thing, especially because the medieval dishes had a very special flavor and very special preparations, and mostly in terms of spices and the spice combinations. However, Christmas food is all medievally spiced, right? Pumpkin pie with nutmeg, cinnamon, ginger, cloves, allspice. That's a typical medieval spice combination for any time of the year. So Christmas is actually a time we eat medievally in some ways.
Rutgers Associate Professor Aaron Hostetter speaking with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller. Hostetter's latest book is called Political Appetites. Though overindulgence is a long-standing holiday tradition, our commentator Solomon Jones says the Christmas message of hope, faith, and love remains true today, and just as in the first Christmas, is embodied in a child.
Christmas began at a time when mankind was searching for answers. Christmas began with a child. A child born into poverty, in a system controlled by the wealthy, in a barn occupied by the filthy, on a night predicted by the wise. Today, such a child might be cast into an underfunded school system or snatched by the social services system. He might end up in an overcrowded prison system because that's what happens to poor children. But the birth of Jesus was different. It was designed to turn conventional wisdom on its ear, to show us that one life, even against seemingly long odds, can rise up and change the world. Christmas reminds us that every child is precious, that every child has potential, that every child can be something more than what we see. That's why we give gifts to children at Christmas, not because they deserve the gifts, but because they are the gifts. My faith tells me that God the Father gave God the Son as the ultimate gift to mankind, a gift that would span generations, teaching us through his own life, death, and resurrection, that love is an action and not a platitude, that love is self-sacrificing, not self-seeking, that love always gives before it takes. That's why Christmas began with a child. In our children, we see ourselves. We see the hope for better lives and the dreams of brighter futures. We see the fear of failures past and the desire to make them right. That's why Christmas began with a child. There are those who will tell us that Christmas is about following the example of the wise men who traveled incredible distances to find a child and give him gifts. There are others who will snidely tell us that Christmas is about the commercialism that too often ensnares us in anxiety. But Christmas, like the child it celebrates, is all about new beginnings. It's about the same thing it was about 2,000 years ago. It's about remaking a world where the poor and defenseless are oppressed by the rich and powerful, where women are devalued by men in authority, where those who are different are cast aside as if they have no purpose. Christmas is the birth of hope in a world where hope is priceless. Christmas is the birth of justice in a world where corruption is rampant. Christmas is the birth of giving in a world that is rife with taking. Christmas is the birth of joy at the notion that one life can change the world. This year, as we celebrate the holiday by exchanging gifts, let's remember that Christmas began with hope. Christmas began with faith. Christmas began with love. But more than anything else, Christmas began with the one thing that encompasses them all. Christmas began with a child. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at WHYY.org, and you can hear him weekdays from 10 till noon on Praise 107.9 FM. As family and friends are gathered for food, football, and fun on this Christmas Day, let's recall an out-of-this-world Christmas for three Americans 49 years ago. Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, told the tale to Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Derek, in 1968, three astronauts had the singular and to date unique experience of circling the moon on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Three astronauts on board Apollo 8, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, did the first circumnavigation of the moon by humans ever. They were the farthest away from Earth humans had ever been before. And here they were, arriving at the moon on Christmas Eve Day. They did 10 orbits around the moon before they headed back, essentially. And on their ninth orbit around the moon, they took some time to read a section from the book of Genesis from the Bible about the creation of the earth. They did this on what would have been Christmas Eve here on earth. And they actually ended that particular video by saying, "We close with good night, good luck, Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth." These are words that are iconic now in the history of space exploration and the celebration of Christmas at the same time.
Perhaps second to Neil Armstrong's famous One Small Step for Man.
Yeah, indeed, because people remember this moment. I think because of the poignancy of the moment of these men being so far from Earth and recognizing the good Earth. This is also the mission on which the Earth was seen in Earthrise for the very first time in history. I mean, you can't see the Earth rising from any place else on Earth. You have to be at the moon. And they saw the Earth as it was rising above the lunar horizon. And that certainly did absolutely cement or burn into our consciousness the fact that the Earth is round. There was no way to escape identifying the Earth as a spherical object with this sighting and with the photographs and film footage from this mission.
Also on this Christmas Day, let's invoke the Bible and what have been described as proto-astronomers.
In fact, when I look at the biblical story of Christmas, the one that really stands out to me is the story of the three wise men who made their way to Bethlehem, according to Scripture, to acknowledge the birth of Jesus Christ and to bring gifts. Well, these three wise men, who were astrologers, the astronomers of their time, the star that they probably followed to Bethlehem was not a star in the strictest sense that we think of it today. And the reason why we can interpret that is because they knew all the stars in the sky. This was a brand new star to them. It was very, very bright. But they didn't think of planets then as we think of planets today. For them, planets would have appeared to be bright stars that seemed to wander across the sky. And we've heard this term, wandering stars. Well, that's what they were to them. And so today, astronomers and theologians can agree that cues that come directly from the Bible indicate that the strongest possibility for what these three astrologers saw at that time was the conjunction, or the joining together, appearing to join together in the sky, three bright planets. And the combination of that would have been a significant event to happen, because it happens so rarely that three of the brightest planets would join together in the same part of the sky. And as astronomers and theologians look at how the timing seems to play out in the Bible of all of the events surrounding that very, very special time, it becomes easier to identify an instant around that particular time 2,000 plus years ago, when there would have been conjunctions of planets, where bright planets appeared together in the sky, that would have drawn the attention of these astrologers and made them think that something very, very significant was happening in a part of the world that they needed to travel to. None of this takes anything away from the faith side of the story at all. It doesn't take anything away from that at all. But I love the fact that it brings together agreement between theologians and scientists about this incredible story.
Thanks, Derek, and Christmas Day greetings to you and yours as well.
Thank you, Dave, and same to you.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Dave Heller returns tomorrow. It's been nearly 1 year since New Jersey eliminated cash bail. Proponents of the change say the bail system used to unfairly detain poor defendants, often on minor charges, while those with means could go free. On tomorrow's show, we'll look at how efforts to overhaul that system have worked. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Davies for Newsworks Tonight.